From NPR and Futuro Media, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa, and today, the battle over Chavez Ravine. There's still a few months left before Major League Baseball starts up again. So for those missing it, we've got a show for you. What you're hearing is from an electric game at Dodger Stadium in the 2018 World Series between the Los Angeles Dodgers and the Boston Red Sox. The Dodgers went on to lose the World Series, but fans lived an unforgettable experience watching the games from the stadium. But often, when you're taking in the game, you're not thinking about the decades-old history of the stadium, especially, for example, an iconic one like Dodger Stadium. So, for some deeper history on the home of the Los Angeles Dodgers, here's producer Janice Yamoka.
So, have you been to a game?
I've been to two games, one when I was like 9 in Chicago, and then one like 10 years ago at Yankee Stadium.
Well, as an Angelino, I've been to Dodger Stadium. It's up on a hill, it's surrounded by palm trees, it has a ton of parking lots, and it has one of the best views of downtown LA. And the Dodgers have a ton of Latino fans, especially Mexican fans. And a lot of it had to do with Fernando Mania.
Fernando Valenzuela has opened the 1981 season with a shutout.
So Fernando Valenzuela, the superstar rookie, he was a kid from Mexico, Sonora, Mexico. And he led the Los Angeles Dodgers to the World Series in 1981. Fernando Mania was super intense.
And the legend of Fernando becomes known to all the world. Todo el mundo.
My dad, like I said, came during the Fernando Mania.
So that's Vicente Montalvo. His dad immigrated from Mexico in the early 70s and really embraced Fernando Mania. And he wanted to share this moment with his son. So he gave Vicente a Fernando Valenzuela Dodgers jacket on his 9th birthday in front of the whole family, including Vicente's grandfather.
Then my grandpa nearly flipped on him, but he just goes, really? And he walked out of the room. I think he knew he was going to blow up to that point.
Whoa, because of a Dodgers jacket?
Exactly. And Vicente's dad was totally shocked. I mean, it was just a Dodgers jacket. Then Vicente's grandfather did something radical.
My dad was never welcome back into their home.
Because he gave him a Dodgers jacket?
Right. So Vicente, who was 9 years old at the time, he was super confused. And he didn't really understand why his grandfather reacted that way most of his life until his early 20s when he finally understood. One day, his grandmother Adela pulled him aside and laid out this entire family history that Vicente had no idea about.
You could see in her face that what she was about to tell me was something that was, it had sat in her mind for a long time. And when she told us about the community, I mean, you could see them, like in their face, you can see them get so emotional.
What does he mean, like the community? Who's he talking about?
Okay, my grandfather is John De Nava, and he grew up in the community of Palo Verde. His wife is Adela De Nava, and she grew up in Palo Verde too, and they both met there.
Palo Verde is one of three neighborhoods that made up a predominantly Mexican-American community. They were Palo Verde, La Loma, and Bishop, and they had over 1,000 families. And altogether, they made something bigger, something that you may know, Maria, as Chavez Ravine.
The Chavez Ravine. So it's about a community. Okay.
Today, the rest of the world may know Chavez Ravine by another name.
The lucky ones are here today at Dodger Stadium.
Dodger Stadium.
Okay, Janice, so how about if you take it away and tell us the story of the Chavez Ravine?
So let's talk about it before it was the home of the Dodgers, when it was actually home to over 1,000 families, because it was a place where Vicente's grandparents fell in love and started a family.
My grandma says, you know, well, this was the Luna de Miel, and they always used to talk about stories about how the dances that they used to have in the community every weekend.
It was a lively neighborhood in the 30s and 40s when Vicente's grandparents were growing up.
So there was almost like a party or a disco night out there where they would go and they would have the band playing. And
they even had a house of their own.
They really felt privileged because they had that stepping stone of owning a home.
Overall, life was good for them. And Chavez Ravine, it was located in a valley and it was a little isolated. But overall, it was really close to downtown LA. And even though this was a neighborhood where they threw weddings, quinceañeras, left their doors unlocked, grew their own produce, and even raised their own livestock,
the city had a very different perspective of the Chavez Ravine neighborhoods.
That's Eric Avila, professor of Chicano Studies and History at UCLA. He's the author of the book Popular Culture in the Age of White Flight and has written extensively about Chavez Ravine.
As far back as the 1930s, the City Housing Authority declared the Chavez Ravine to be a slum in need of rehabilitation.
He told me that this was because Chavez Ravine was a low-income neighborhood, not well served by transit lines, and most of the time lacked basic needs like electricity. People used candles to light up their homes and their streets at night.
So the city in the 1930s targeted the Chavez Ravine for the placement of a public housing project.
And then President Harry Truman was pushing for something called the Housing Act of 1949 as part of the Fair Deal, which gave federal dollars to build housing projects all across the country. Los Angeles got $110 million because of the Housing Act that they could directly use toward public housing. And Chavez Ravine, without electricity, its poor transit, was the perfect site for this.
And this would mean the destruction of the old neighborhood and then the construction of new public housing units in which the old residents would have first dibs to move in.
Here's how it would work. First, they had to get rid of all the residents. Second, they'd have to tear down all the houses. Then, they'd build the public housing and the old neighbors could come back into their new, more modern homes. So by 1950, the Los Angeles Housing Authority sent letters to every home in Chavez Ravine, telling them that their houses were going to be torn down and new ones built in their place. But not to worry. For the many families who qualify for public housing, they'll get first dibs on the new Chavez Ravine once it was done, in about 2 years. It sounded like a good deal, except that saying no was not an option. The city had the power to force them to either sell or get evicted. It's something called eminent domain. What eminent domain basically means is that cities have the power to take private property, as long as it's for public use, like parks or roads, after they pay the owner of that property a fair price. But in many cases, even today, the government tries to lowball property owners, offering only a fraction of the property's value. And the owners could get a lawyer to try to get a better deal, but you need to spend money for that. So in many cases, even when people don't want to leave, they take the deal, which is what many did. And their houses were soon demolished.
By 1952, almost all of the residents had moved out on the premise that they would be able to return to the old neighborhood, moving into these new public housing projects.
Some families resisted, but overall, even if it felt shady, it seemed like a good deal. Think about a college campus, tall towers, lush landscaping, modern structures with modern facilities, electricity, water, the works, everything that the residents lacked in Chavez Ravine. That's what the city told the residents they would get if they sold their homes. So slowly, residents trickled out of Chavez Ravine. Meanwhile, 1 mile south, things were changing at City Hall. The mayorship of LA was about to change, and the new candidate, his name was Norris Polson. He was a congressman that had a ton of well-connected friends like the Chandler family, who owned and operated a little newspaper called the Los Angeles Times.
And they were staunchly opposed to the idea of public housing in the immediate vicinity of downtown Los Angeles.
And there were a few reasons for their opposition. One, they believed that public housing would not maximize the economic value of downtown. And another reason was
this idea of racial integration in the immediate vicinity of downtown.
So Polson, the man running for mayor, made anti-public housing the foundation of his campaign. And he used the Red Scare to attack it. And the rhetoric that he used, public housing was a secret communist strategy to create communist cells in the heart of downtown. That's something that Eric calls red baiting.
And Polson, closely coordinating with the Chandler family, the Los Angeles Times, and other downtown elites, effectively used this red-baiting strategy. And he promised that if he won the mayoral election, that one of the first things that he would do in office as mayor would be to cancel the city's bid for public housing.
And then, in 1953, Polson won the election and became mayor. And he kept his promise.
One of the first acts that he signed as mayor was the cancellation of public housing, not just in the Chavez Ravine, but in other parts of the city as well.
So here are hundreds of families who left their homes, and now there would be no promised place to live and no Chavez Ravine. It's important to note that not every family left the neighborhood with a government buyout of sorts. a couple families stayed.
And they were perfectly happy in their home with their yard and their garden and their livestock and their neighbors, and they had no interest in leaving.
It was basically a ghost town. Most of it had been destroyed, and the ravine sat in limbo. But once the plans for public housing were gone, it made way for something else to be built. Something bigger.
Coming up on Latino USA, we continue the story of the Chavez Ravine. Stay with us, no te vayas.
This week on Ask Me Another, we've got TV's favorite muscle man, Terry Crews from Brooklyn Nine-Nine, and he chats about his multiple talents and how he stays humble in Hollywood. It's dropping in your feeds Friday, January 18th on NPR's Hour of Puzzles, Word Games, and Trivia.
Hey, we're back. And before the break, we were talking about the history of Dodger Stadium and the land that it's located on, Chavez Ravine. Now, at the time, many residents of Chavez Ravine had sold their homes after being promised public housing. But those plans were canceled by a new mayor, and the ravine itself, where their old homes were, sat in limbo. Here's Janice with the rest of the story.
Over on the East Coast, Walter O'Malley, the owner of the Brooklyn Dodgers, was unhappy with his location in Brooklyn. The stadium was old, the neighborhood was changing, and New York City officials weren't helping him. O'Malley wanted out.
So very quietly, 1953, 1954, 1955, city officials began working behind the scenes with Walter O'Malley to negotiate the possibility of a relocation from Brooklyn to Los Angeles.
And guess what LA city officials suggested?
The bait in their negotiations with O'Malley was the Chavez Ravine. And that's when many officials began to see the Chavez Ravine as the perfect site for a modern Major League Baseball stadium, the kind that O'Malley was asking for in New York, but city officials would not give him.
So eventually the city Dodger contract was created in 1958. And it essentially handed Chavez Ravine over to O'Malley as a kind of gift. It was an offer O'Malley couldn't refuse. And that's when it became a full-blown political battle. Mexican-American city councilman Edward Roybal led the resistance.
And his criticism was on behalf of the displaced residents of the Chavez Ravine, saying, how can you argue against public subsidies for decent housing for poor people and then turn around and provide corporate subsidies for Walter O'Malley and the Los Angeles Dodgers by essentially handing the Chavez Ravine over to a very wealthy, very shrewd, very successful negotiator, private businessman like Walter O'Malley.
At the end, all was for naught. The contract was approved in 1958, 5 years after the public housing plans were canceled. It was the final green light for building Dodger Stadium. There was just one thing standing in the way, the families that refused to leave, including the Arechigas, who later became the face of resistance to this eviction. On May 8, 1959, the city of Los Angeles took matters into their own hands. The LA County Sheriff's deputies arrived in a bunch of patrol cars to evict Chavez Ravine's final residents.
And when the people inside the home refused to leave, the sheriffs, with a warrant, went in and physically removed the people from their home.
An old Mexican woman was lifted from a rocking chair. Children were crying. A young woman was dragged out by four deputies, pulling her apart by each limb. Everyone kicking, screaming, and weeping. And once everyone was out, the bulldozers were on scene, ready for destruction. At the time, live broadcast journalism was taking off in the United States, so cameramen and television reporters were on the scene. And the viewers watched with the family as their house turned into rubble.
The broadcast of these images on national television, live images on national television, left a very bitter legacy of racial tension between LA's Mexican-American community and the Los Angeles Dodgers. And this is the legacy of conflict upon which Dodger Stadium was built.
3 years and $18 million later, Dodger Stadium opened its doors on April 10th, 1962.
Opening day, 1962.
That day, the Los Angeles Dodgers lost 6-3 to the Cincinnati Reds. Vicente Montalvo, the man we heard from at the beginning of the story, whose dad gave him a Dodgers jacket, he and most of his family live only minutes away from Dodger Stadium, which stands as a reminder of the shady dealings in violent eviction. His grandparents, his mom, she was about 8 at the time, and her siblings left their home in 1959, right before the evictions became violent. And out of all the memories Vicente's grandmother shared with him, the night his family decided to leave their home always stands out the most.
They were discussing what were the options. Either we leave because they're going to bring force in. They were already threatening them with the sheriffs. So my grandparents said, you know, we got kids. And they said, look, there's only one option we can do, is if we pick up and just give it to them. My grandparents have always told me that we can never use the word compensation. Because in the sense of compensation, they would have been given fair market value. What they were given were peanuts, and that's what they use as peanuts. It was never to justify what the property was worth.
They never became homeowners again.
Because we owned our home, they really thought that they had a piece of the American dream. And what they really found out is that it was an illusion for them. Because the American dream had laws. And some of these laws were like eminent domain. And eminent domain is what took their dream away from them.
Eventually, his grandparents settled in Echo Park, where Vicente grew up, a few miles west of their original home. His grandparents are now in their 90s, and he's still learning new stories about the old neighborhood. Vicente's a founding member of Buried Under the Blue, an organization that's dedicated to preserving the history of the three neighborhoods, Palo Verde, La Loma, and Bishop, the parts that made up Chavez Ravine that now lie buried under Dodger Stadium. To this day, whenever Vicente's grandfather passes by the stadium...
You know, Grandpa used to go up to the gate every time we passed that darn gate, and he would spit on the floor and he would give them the bird.
He makes his opinion clear.
This story originally aired in 2017. Today, Vicente Montalvo, with the organization Buried Under the Blue, continues to preserve the oral histories of the elders of Chavez Ravine to make sure the stories of their communities stay alive. His grandfather, John, is 98, and his grandmother, Adela, is 94. Hey, John and Adela. This episode was reported by Janice Yamoka and edited by Nadia Raymond. The Latino USA team includes Miguel Macias, Antonia Cerejido, Maggie Freeling, and Sayer Quevedo. We're edited by Marlon Bishop and Sofia Baliza Carr, with additional editing by Allison McAdam. Our engineers are Stephanie LeBeau and Julia Caruso. Our production manager is Natalia Fidelholtz. Our theme music was composed by Zenia Rubinos. If you like the music you heard on this episode, stop by latinousa.org and check out our weekly Spotify playlist. And one more thing, dear podcast listener, we really love it when you rate and review our show. It takes you a second to do, but it really helps us to get new listeners. So please do that. And also, your comments help keep our team super motivated. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Join us again on our next episode. And in the meantime, look for us on all of your social media. Ciao.
Latino USA is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation and the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide.
Oh, yes. quick, say something. No, say it now. React now. What am I reacting to again? I'm Maria Hinojosa, and next time on Latino USA, we talk to a Latina pioneer in science, one of the first and few Latinas to work in the jet propulsion labs at NASA. Her name is Silvia Acevedo, and she's now the CEO of the Girl Scouts. That's next time on Latino USA.